I'll go ahead and turn to Joshua chapter 24. And as you make your way there, let me just say that despite the heat and the humidity of early in this week especially, this is still by far my favorite part of the year, by far. Over the past month, as many of you already know, I've been giving out vegetables almost on a daily basis. When I go to work, I usually have two or three little bags of cherry tomatoes and some peppers or cucumbers or zucchini or broccoli. I've got a collection of things. And it's almost every day at work, I'm bringing something there. But even though I take as much as I can over there, the demand at work is still greater than my supply. And for that reason, I'm very thankful for my next door neighbors. We have Don and Sandra, which as you're facing the parsonage, the house to the right, Don and Sandy live there, and they have an abundance of cherry tomatoes. And so there's been a couple times where I get a message, hey, I've got a bunch of tomatoes. Do you have a place to take them? And I'm like, yes, I absolutely do. And so I take those tomatoes over, and it helps keep the people at bay that are still wanting more over there. I probably give away about 90% or more of what I grow. And like I said, with all the stuff that I give away, I also lose track of who I owe stuff to. So if I take peppers to two or three people, I usually have a fourth one saying, hey, where are my peppers? So, okay, I'll get you next. And then I forget who was the person that I was supposed to take broccoli to, who is the person I was supposed to give peppers. But they remind me, let me tell you, they remind me who's next. Like I said, I probably give away 90% of what I grow, and even though gardening is a daily chore, a daily labor for me, it is a labor of love. I love seeing new life. I love the process of watching that new life grow and mature and thrive, and I love watching nature buzz around all of my plants and getting their little pollen fix and flying off to their little bee homes. A little over a week ago, I had just finished watering the garden and doing that process. And as I was rolling up the hose reel with the big hose, I was just finishing with that, and I noticed a bee underneath the hose reel. And when I saw it, I was a little bit worried. I love taking care of nature and watching out for nature, and I hate killing anything. And so I was worried. I thought maybe when I was rolling, something had gotten hit. Maybe he was under there, and I didn't realize it. And so he was just sitting there. And so I got a little stick, and I reached down there to see if he would get on there and see if he was okay, and he climbed onto that stick, and so I lifted him up and examined, and I've never really seen a bee that close, so I didn't know if anything looked wrong or not anyways. But after a few seconds, it buzzed off and buzzed around me a couple trips and flew away just a little ways, just a few feet, and stopped, came back, did a couple more trips around, and then off it went into a tree. So I'm assuming that bee is fine. I love nature. I love watching plants produce fruit. And then I love the ability to share that fruit with others. But here's what I don't love. I don't love the work. I appreciate the work. I value the work. I do the work. But ultimately, I do not love work. I love what work produces, not necessarily the work itself. The joy that I feel when I have these fully ripe vegetables to take to work is not the same thing as when I'm having to, you know, cultivate the soil and pull out weeds and build raised garden beds. Or when I initially built the beds, I had all this soil I had to transport from the corner of the parking lot, one load after another. That was not a fun day. That was Trevor helping me with that one, I believe, with all those trips. That work isn't fun or joyful, but it is worth it. I also don't love waiting for the vegetables to arrive, but when they do actually arrive, I kind of forget about that whole waiting thing because I'm so excited about the vegetables. There's no comparison between the taste of garden-grown veggies and the mass-produced veggies you get at the store. Today, I am enjoying tomatoes, zucchinis, cucumbers, and broccoli and peppers that are the direct result of decisions and preparations and work that I did months ago. 3 months ago, back in May, when I started getting the soil ready, started planting the plants, I was able to watch them and nourish them in order to do what I do today, which is give them away. And with that, let's read from Joshua chapter 24. Go ahead and stand with me as I read. It's Joshua 24. I'm going to read verse 1 and part of verse 2, and then I'm going to skip down to verses 14 and 18. The gap in between there is a continuation of what the Lord says. So at the very end, we're just kind of catching the last part of God's message to the people through Joshua. Joshua 24, beginning verse 1. Then Joshua assembled all the tribes of Israel at Shechem. He summoned elders, leaders, judges, and officials of Israel, and they presented themselves before God. Joshua said to all the people, "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says." Now skip down to verse 14, jumping into the middle of that conversation. "Now fear the Lord and serve him with all faithfulness. Throw away the gods of your forefathers worshipped beyond the river and in Egypt, and serve the Lord. But if serving the Lord seems undesirable to you, then choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve, whether the gods your forefathers served beyond the river or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you are living. But as for me and my household, we will serve the Lord." Then the people answered, "Far be it from us to forsake the Lord to serve other gods. It was the Lord our God himself who brought us and our fathers up out of Egypt from that land of slavery and performed those great signs before our eyes. He protected us on our entire journey and among all the nations through which we traveled. And the Lord drove out before us all the nations, including the Amorites, who lived in the land. We too will serve the Lord because he is our God." The word of God for the people of God. Thanks be to God. Go ahead and be seated. After leading the people of Israel for quite some time, Joshua had been leading them for a long time, and not too long after this, he would be laid to rest with his forefathers. So after leading them for quite some time, the entire family of God and his family find themselves at a point of decision. They are located in the Promised Land at this time. They are precisely where they're supposed to be geographically, but there is a decision that they need to make because they need to be where they're supposed to be relationally with God. Who are they going to serve with the lives that they're living? They have options, as it talks about in that passage. They can go back to Egypt. They can start to serve those gods again like some of their forefathers did. They can turn to the gods of the Amorites who are living in their midst, or they can do exactly as Joshua did, which was insist on serving the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Recognizing that you are at a crucial point of decision is important. Far too often there are times where the point for making a decision has been avoided altogether. You put off making a decision. Far too often decisions are made far later than they should have been made. Making the right decision too late to make any real difference isn't helpful. Sometimes there are right decisions which should have been made weeks or months or maybe even years ago. So the ability to recognize when you are at a point of decision is an important first step. Once that recognition is made, once you know that you are at a point of decision, at that point there's no avoiding it, there's no ignoring it, there's no delaying it, there is only addressing it. Lay the situation out there as plainly as possible and then make the decision. Joshua was clear with the people of Israel. Choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve. Now, depending on the person and depending on the circumstances, making decisions, even simple decisions, can be an agonizing process. If you've ever asked someone, "Where would you like to eat for dinner?" you know that sometimes that can be a lengthy, agonizing process. Now, I don't know if you've realized this around here. I didn't have this problem growing up because I grew up in the country. There were no nearby restaurants. There was no place easy to get food. You went to the grocery store, you brought your food home. And so for us, eating out was a rarity. But if you've looked around this area, you know there are a lot of places to eat. Lori and I have lived here for a little over 4 years, and we have eaten at a lot of places, and there is still a ton more that we've never, ever been to. We've not even scratched the surface on the number of places to eat. Now, on Friday nights, Lori and I have started a new thing, and maybe about a month and a half ago, we decided that every Friday night when we'd eat out for dinner, that's a typical time when we would eat out, we are going to eat at a new place every single time. And so we've been working through a little list of places we wanted to try. Now, years ago, I tried to hand off any and all decision-making processes for making the decision on where to eat because I can be indecisive at times, and I'm hungry for everything all the time, and so trying to decide what I'm hungry for doesn't exactly work. So I told Lori, "Hey, you're in charge of deciding where we're going to eat. I will not have any complaints," but she still asks me, "Where do I want to eat?" I think it's just a consideration. For me, usually it's a matter of how much do we want to spend and do we want to eat fast or sit down and eat. While there are plenty of trivial situations where an agonizing or prolonged decision-making process doesn't have any real negative consequences, there are plenty of times where the failure to make a decision in a timely and wise manner can have devastating consequences. And many of you probably are aware, watching the news just a few weeks ago, when there was that condo collapse down in Florida, killing over 100 people. The problems and the dangers in that building were apparent long before that tragedy ever happened. Instead of making the right decision to address those problems, things were put off. When you have structural problems that have a hefty price tag along with them, and you either don't have the kind of money to fix that major problem or you don't want to spend that kind of money, you just kick the can down the road. We will get to it. The thinking that eventually you will get around to fixing those major problems. The right time for the right decision to fix those structural problems in that condo complex for that building was long before it ever collapsed. They waited too long, and instead of there just being a financial cost, there was the cost of human lives. If only they had chosen on the day a decision should have been made, much of that could have been avoided. Here's the really annoying thing about making important decisions. The day you choose isn't the day you get to reap the benefits of your choice. As I mentioned before about my garden veggies, what I get to enjoy right now is the result of planting decisions and soil preparations work that I did 3 months ago. Decisions and work that also benefit from the decisions and work I did years ago when I cleared out space in the yard and dug little trenches and put those boxes in. Boxes that are going to need to be replaced because I didn't get treated wood or anything like that, and they're starting to rot a little. Now I'll have to rebuild it and do the work again. In between the decisions and the work 3 months ago and 4 years ago has been a collection of work, 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 and more work. Work by itself is not fun. This week at work, I got pinched, swung at, kicked, headbutted, and had a metal travel mug whiz past my head, and that was just Wednesday. And that wasn't Bible study Wednesday. This was the other job. This wasn't a Bible study. We had the Wednesday off, so this is the other job. How many pastors out there can say that that was their experience this week? And I imagine there's not many, and I hope if they do have that situation, it wasn't a church-related experience where they were getting physically attacked. This is just one of those joys of bivocational ministry. Hopefully the pastors who only have the job of pastoring, and one day I hope to have that sort of situation where all I do is pastor and minister for the church. Work isn't fun. Reaping a harvest is fun. Wouldn't it be nice if you could just jump from a decision into reaping the benefits of that decision without there being so much work in between? Deciding to eat healthy and then jumping into smaller jeans. Deciding to invest in a retirement account and then jumping into the joy of experiencing retirement. Deciding to start a devotional life or a prayer life and then jumping into being the very likeness of Jesus. You are not going to be smaller or be ready for retirement or be like Jesus on the basis of a decision. Yes, a moment of decision is absolutely necessary, but if that decision is not followed up by effort, that decision is meaningless and leads nowhere. 5 years from now, in 2026, Calvary Church of the Nazarene will be celebrating its 100th anniversary. And there's not many churches, Nazarene churches, that can say they have a 100-year history. There are Nazarene churches that started much later than this church, and there are also churches that never ever made it to their 100th birthday. Organized as a church in 1926 up on Roseland during the Roaring Twenties with Calvin Coolidge as the president, we have the unique opportunity to celebrate during a new era in a new location the work that a collection of people started long ago. The question that we need to ask today, though, is, what will we be celebrating 5 years from now? Who will be celebrating 5 years from now? Will there be something even worth celebrating 5 years from now? I don't know what qualifies as a celebratory occasion for you, but for me, simply surviving as you reach a significant milestone is more sad than celebratory. Arriving at an anniversary, barely holding on and sharing stories about the good old days of long ago, but nothing in the future that you're looking forward to is the kind of situation where wouldn't it just be better to pull the plug? what that anniversary day in 2026 looks like, if and when it gets here, will be largely determined by what we do or start doing today. More than just the decisions we make, the actions we take will have an impact on the harvest that we do or do not get to see. In recent years, leaders in our denomination at large with the Church of the Nazarene and leaders on our district as a part of Chicago Central District have been working on and developing and implementing tools and resources for the revitalization of churches. While much of the hype and the buzz in church growth conversations center around church planting and those kinds of strategies, there is a tremendous need in many denominations, and not just ours, for those denominations to address the needs of established churches, especially churches that need revitalization because they are in a life cycle that isn't healthy or productive. Now, a few months ago, when our DS was letting it be known that they would be promoting and organizing an opportunity for pastors and churches to be engaged in a program with hopes of revitalizing pastors and churches and ministries, I immediately reached out to him and let him know that I wouldn't mind being on the front end of those gatherings. Put me in the earliest group you can. This past Thursday night, I had the opportunity to be in a Zoom meeting with five other pastors and a couple other people in there as well, who all have the similar interest in this program, as we got the basic orientation overview of what a revitalization process looks like. And here's what it sounded to me. When all was said and done, when the meeting was over and I left that meeting and got back home, when all that was said and done, here's what it sounded like to me. It sounded an awful lot like work. So there I was on Thursday night, a day after I'd just gotten beaten up and had stuff thrown at me at one job, and I'm one day away from starting the process of writing and putting together this message. And here I was in this meeting being invited to a process that was going to give me more work to do. Let's just say that my attitude and my at the conclusion of that meeting was not a cheerful, excited, energetic kind of attitude. And Lori can vouch for me on that. I was not excited. I was exhausted. It's Thursday night. It's been a long week. At the very same time, the work that was being prescribed, the work that was being suggested, is exactly the kind of work that needs to be done here at Calvary. A piece of land does not just become a bountiful harvest-producing farm by simply deciding to be a bountiful harvest-producing farm. There's a lot of hard work that needs to be done, from surveying the land, leveling things out, removing large obstacles like trees or large rocks, removing all of that as a way to prepare the soil. All of that work comes before planting seeds and watering seeds, and then watching God do the miraculous work of making those seeds grow. While there are things over the past 4.5 years that have been worked on during my years here, as a part of preparing and doing things to get the church ready, there is still actually a lot of work to do. There is wisdom in knowing when you don't have the wisdom you need. There is wisdom in knowing when you need help. That's why I reached out to the district in the first place. Because prior to coming here, coming to this church, I grew up in a church that went from 450 people to 650 during the years that I was there as a kid growing up. The church I attended while I was in college was a church for over 800, and for 4 years, Lori and I attended a church of over 6,000. For 4 years and 5 months, I've had the task of not only trying to figure out what this pastoring thing even looks like, but also the task of learning what it means to be a part of a small church. This is still a very new experience for me, and there is still much to learn. With all of that being said, this revitalization process, which hopes to prepare the soil here at Calvary so we can be a more active part of the kingdom harvest, will involve more people than just myself. Ultimately, it will include anyone and everyone who calls Calvary their church home, even for those people we know that we may see them just every couple years or so that come in. Eventually, they need to be brought in and made a part of the process of what we're doing here. If this is our church, then it is our responsibility to do our part in making this a church what it can be, with the help and the guidance and the empowerment of God's Spirit every step along the way. In the coming weeks, very soon, in the next few weeks, I'll be providing more details, more descriptions of what that process entails. But alongside of that process, there are five things that I know I'm going to need from every person at Calvary to make that process as smooth and as successful as possible. The first is prayer. If you aren't doing so already, be praying for your pastor, be praying for your brothers and sisters in Christ, be praying for your church, and be praying for the witness of this church in this community. While you can oversaturate a plant with water in a way that is damaging and drowns a plant, there is no such thing as oversaturating a church with prayer. Too much prayer is an impossibility. Too little prayer is for far too many churches a current reality. If you are praying, pray more. If you aren't praying, start. While prayer is something we are all called to do, prayer isn't the only thing we are called to do. You're also going to need to participate. As Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 27, now you are the body of Christ, and every one of you is a part of it. Every body part in the body of Christ has a place and has a purpose. This process involves the entire body because it impacts the entire body. So your voice matters. Your knowledge and your experiences matter. Working in unison and in collaboration with other body parts isn't going to happen if body parts are not in communication with each other. A team of rowers in a rowboat isn't going to be effective if they aren't in sync with each other. They can't be rowing at different times in different directions, or that boat will just spin around in circles or make its way haphazardly around whatever body of water they're in. You have to know what's going on. You have to know where we are aiming as a church. You have to know why we do what we do. Change isn't just for the sake of change. The only way that happens is if you participate and engage in the conversations we'll be having. Now, this part might be more difficult for some than others, but the plan laid out in the revitalization process is a 20-month process. And when I heard that, I'm thinking of 20 months of work. The workload was more than I thought when I heard some initial details, and then I got more in details. But it is a 20-month process, almost 2 years. Now, some might say, that sounds like an awful long time. That you can get a nice harvest of asparagus in 20 months. That's how long that is. Isn't there some sort of a 3-month plan that we can more quickly see results and enjoy a harvest? And while I wish that there were a quick fix and a fast path to a fruitful harvest, the reality is that there is no quick fix for over 20 years of gradual decline, with maybe only a couple years of increase mixed in there. If you ever want to see a chart of showing the growth and decline of Calvary from 1926 all the way until today, I can tell you where to find it, and you can see what I have seen. In 1978, the year that I was born, the average attendance recorded for Calvary was at its highest at 96 people. In 1988, it was 35. In 1998, it was 67. In 2008, it was 64, with a peak and a valley in between there. In 2018, it was 35. Ups and downs, peaks and valleys, and a collection of pastors all along the way. There are a variety of reasons why some pastors have very short tenures at churches, but here is one of them that I know. They can get so fixated on getting fast results that when they don't see results in those first 2 or 3 years, they get frustrated and then they leave. And then usually they're finger pointing along the way, blaming the church and blaming the church people. It's their fault for things not being fruitful. That kind of an attitude is not only unfair, it's also not realistic. That kind of attitude is not fair, and it's also not realistic to have that kind of a fast fruit expectation. Becoming a part of a community takes time. Getting to know your neighbors, the ones that give you tomatoes to take to work, that takes time. Developing a deep love for a congregation takes time. Developing a trust for a pastor takes time. All of the things you need for a congregation to establish a lasting ministry of Christ-like influence in a community takes time. And so getting things back in the right direction is going to take some time as well. Anybody who's in it for the long haul is also going to need persistence, the kind of attitude where people keep trying despite failures or disappointments along the way, the kind of attitude where when you get knocked down, you get yourself back up and you shake the dust off your clothes and you move on towards your next attempt. Effective and fruitful ministry to a community requires a sustained collective effort. Standalone ministry outreach events scattered randomly here or there over the course of many years you're not going to get the kind of results you might hope for. In order to connect with and impact a community, you need to be visible in the community in a variety of ways as a part of a larger collective aim. That means we need to be routinely searching for and routinely attempting new ways to connect and serve our community. Some of those may be fruitful, and some of them may be futile. And in the instances where they are futile and not fruitful, that is where you need persistence. And lastly, we're going to need positivity every step of the way. If you're a pessimist looking for something to be negative and critical about, I have no doubt that you will find exactly what you need to keep yourself unhappy. That's fine. Just don't be a contagious unhappy person. Keep it to yourself, because we don't need that right now. There are too many other things that need to be done. We need to be people who know how to encourage. We need people who know how to hold on to hope. We need people who know how to provide constructive criticism so that when something is not good, there's a path to make it better. There is always room for that kind of feedback, which can lead to a positive outcome. Negative and critical comments don't lead anywhere helpful. If our desire this morning is to prepare the soil here at Calvary so that we are ready to faithfully respond to God's call on our lives, prayer, participation, patience, persistence, and positivity are going to go a long way in that endeavor. May the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be pleasing to you, O Lord, my rock and my redeemer. This morning, we're going to be closing with the song, I Will Follow. And as I mentioned before, you know, decision is one thing, but decisions that aren't followed up with action, that's what we need. And so this morning, as we sing this song, don't think of it as a decision moment, but think of it more in terms of a decision leading to action kind of moment. Where God goes, that's where we will go. Where God stays, that's where we'll stay. When God moves, we need to be ready and willing to move. Choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve. On the other side of that decision, there is some work that needs to be done. And while you may not like the work, I can promise you that you will love the harvest. Now go ahead and stand as we sing.